sprint. Yes, you can radically transform your body and life and enjoy the ride, but no matter how you look at it, it takes a real investment of time and effort. The tricky thing about building muscle and strength is that it comes slowly, bit by bit. If you're just starting out, you're going to see huge jumps in strength for the first several months, but eventually your progress will slow down. From that point on, you will have to consciously work for every rep of improvement in your lifts and every pound of muscle added to your frame. This is where things get hazy for people who don't keep journals. Unless you have superhuman memory, you won't know exactly what you did the previous week for the various exercises in your workout. Sure, you might make a mental note of the ego lifts like bench press and dumbbell curls, but what about everything else? You need to approach all lifts with the same attention to detail. When you don't know what you did the previous week, you don't know what you're shooting for this week. As your goal with every workout is to do just a little more than the last time you performed it, even if it's just one more rep with the same weights, you can see the problem here. When you step up to the bar, you don't want to be trying to remember what you did last week. You want to know exactly what you're going for. Hell, some people like to even visualize themselves performing the set successfully and say it helps. If you bench pressed 245 for 4 reps last week, all you care about when you get under that bar is pressing it for 5 reps. Go ahead and even see yourself doing it in your mind's eye. Then the next week your goal is 6 reps on the first set, at which point you'll add weight and go for 4 reps on the second set. This is how you build strength, one rep at a time. A successful workout is one where you made progress, where you got one more rep than last week or moved up in weight. If this doesn't happen, don't despair, but you need to push harder the next week. If you're stuck for several weeks or even moving backward, you need to check your nutrition and rest because something is off. The bottom line is that if you don't keep a training journal, it gets real sloppy real quick. Lifting random amounts of weight for random numbers of reps every week doesn't work nearly as well as an accurate linear model of progression driven by real data. How to keep a training journal. You have a few options for keeping a training journal. One, you can use an app such as the completely awesome one I'm developing called Stacked. www.getstackedapp.com. GetStackedApp.com. Two, you can try other apps on the market, but expect to be disappointed. You'll probably find it easier to just use a note-taking app on your phone or even a plain old notebook that you write in each week. 3. You can pick up the pre-made printed journal called The Year 1 Challenge for Men, which has an entire year's worth of bigger, leaner, stronger workouts that you can fill out as you progress on the program. If you're creating your own journal, list the exercises you're going to do for the day and look at the previous week's numbers. Assess whether your goal is to go up in reps or weight this week and start your workout, recording what you do in each set, the weight lifted, reps done, and any relevant notes. Here's an example of how I kept my written journal before switching to an app. Week 4, Monday, 8-14-14, 192 pounds. Chest, bench press, 275 times 4, times 4, times 4, feel strong. Incline dumbbell press, 110 times 5, times 5, times 4. Flat dumbbell press, 110 times 5, times 5, times 5. Simple enough. I often make notes if I feel particularly strong or weak on an exercise, if some kind of ache or pain bothers me, if I didn't sleep well the night before, etc. The next week, I would review these numbers and plan on doing something like 5 times 5 times 4, or even 5 times 4 times 4, with 275 on my bench press. If I did that and the rest of the workout was exactly the same as the previous week, that's a successful workout. You will also want to keep track of your body weight, and you have two options here. One, weigh yourself once per 7 days. On the same day each week, in the morning, in the nude, after going to the bathroom, and on an empty stomach. 2. Weigh yourself every day under the same conditions as above and calculate the average weight once every 7 days. Here's how this looks. Day 1, 192.1. Day 2, 192. Day 3, 191. Day 4, 191.8. Day 5, 193. Day 6, 191.3. Day 7, 190.7. 7-day average, 191.7. I prefer the averaging method because it makes sure you don't get thrown off by a bad weigh-in, which can be caused by something as simple as holding more water that day or having more food still in you that day. The bottom line, no matter how good of a workout program you follow, if you don't keep a training journal and either plan or track food intake, you're almost guaranteed to run into problems. Keeping your journal like this allows you to always have your eye on improvement and to never fall backward or get stuck for long periods. When you see your numbers plateauing, you can jump on it right away and not let months go by before you realize that nothing is changing. And 9 times out of 10, getting back on track is easy, as getting stuck is usually caused by not pushing yourself hard enough in your workouts, not eating right, or not resting enough, or a combination of the three. Chapter summary. One of the most effective ways to prevent getting stuck in a rut of no gains is simply to track your numbers. When you step up to the bar, you don't want to be trying to remember what you did last week. You want to know exactly what you're going for. Hell, some people like to even visualize themselves performing the set successfully and say it helps. A successful workout is one where you made progress, where you got one more rep than last week, or moved up in weight. If this doesn't happen, don't despair, but you need to push harder the next week. If you're stuck for several weeks or even moving backward, you need to check your nutrition and rest because something is off. The bottom line is that if you don't keep a training journal, it gets real sloppy real quick. Lifting random amounts of weight for random numbers of reps every week doesn't work nearly as well as an accurate linear model of progression driven by real data. Chapter 20, The Code of a Good Training Partner. The question isn't who is going to let me, it's who is going to stop me. Ayn Rand. Working out with a bad partner sucks. It drains your energy and motivation and can even cause you to lose enthusiasm for working out altogether. On the other hand, working out with a good partner can go far in keeping you on track and making progress. He helps keep you accountable and wanting to show up every day, and having a spot on certain exercises helps push you for another rep and encourages you to move up in weight as you should. These things can make a big difference as time goes on. Those workouts, additional reps, and progressions in weight that wouldn't have happened if you were solo add up to real gains. So I recommend that you find someone to work out with before you start, and the two of you should agree to the following code. 1. I will show up on time for every workout, and if I can't avoid missing one, I'll let my partner know as soon as I know. 2. I won't let my partner get out of a workout easily. I will reject any excuses that are short of an actual emergency or commitment that can't be rescheduled, and I will insist that he comes and trains. In the case where there's a valid excuse, if at all possible, I'll offer to train at a different time so we can get our workout in. 3. I will come to the gym to train, not to chat. When we're in the gym, we focus on our workouts, we're always ready to spot each other, and we get our work done efficiently. 4. I will train hard to set a good example for my partner. 5. I will push my partner to do more than he thinks he can. It's my job to motivate him to do more weight and more reps than he believes possible. 6. I will be supportive of my partner and will compliment him on his gains. Such a code might seem cheesy, but if you and your partner agree to these 6 points, you'll be doing each other a huge favor and will be helping each other more than you might realize. If your partner can't follow these points, if he is inconsistent in showing up, is more interested in chatting than lifting, trains lethargically, fails to push you to do more, etc., he's a liability and is doing more harm than good. You're better off training alone. Chapter 21, How to Prevent Workout Injuries. Strength does not come from winning. Your struggles develop your strengths. When you go through hardships and decide not to surrender, that is strength. Arnold Schwarzenegger. At first glance, it would seem to make sense that weightlifting would, over time, lead to injuries or at least joint problems. I mean, how good can it possibly be for our bodies to squat, push, and pull hundreds of pounds over and over? Wouldn't it speed up the wear and tear on the joints, tendons, and ligaments, and thus the onset of osteoarthritis, the degradation of the joints? Interestingly enough, research doesn't support these assumptions. For example, one study conducted by researchers at the Glasgow Royal Infirmary analyzed the bodies of 25 competitive weightlifters, people who spend a lot more time training and lift a lot more weight than you or I do, and found that on the whole, their joints were as healthy or healthier than other people their age. Furthermore, about half of the subjects admitted they were using anabolic steroids regularly, which means their joints were under even more strain than usual from the excessive weights lifted. Researchers also found that previously injured joints were more susceptible to joint degeneration than healthy joints. Thus, those with injured joints may need to dial back the intensity of their weightlifting to preserve their joint health. You see, the reality is that weightlifting just isn't a dangerous activity. You're far more likely to get injured playing just about any sport than you are lifting weights. Nevertheless, this doesn't answer the questions as to why so many weightlifters seem to have shoulder, knees, and lower back problems. If weightlifting isn't inherently bad for your joints, what's going on here? Well, it's true that weightlifting injuries are on the rise, and this is most likely because the number of people doing it is also on the rise. Mass movements like CrossFit don't help either, as a bad instructor is all it takes for a large group of people to dramatically increase the risk of injury. That said, as with any physical activity, the occasional ache or strain is inevitable, but if you do certain things wrong, you can get hurt, and it will probably involve a joint like the shoulder, knee, or lower back. Injury risk mistake number one, lifting more weight than you can handle. According to research conducted by scientists on behalf of the Center for Injury Research and Policy, the most common way people injure themselves while weightlifting is dropping weights on themselves. And how do people increase the risk of dropping weights on themselves? They ego lift. They stack the plates and just hope for the best. I cringe when I see skinny guys load 3 or 4 plates on either side of the bar, only to perform shaky quarter reps with a spot. All it will take is a slightly too fast descent or a momentary tweak of the back or knee, and Humpty Dumpty will have a great fall. Trying to lift too much weight also puts excessive strain on your joints, tendons, and ligaments. By working with weights that you can properly handle, however, and by doing full controlled reps, you not only avoid that problem, but you also make better gains and improve flexibility. Here's the bottom line. If you can't get full reps, you're using too much weight, and you're increasing your risk of injury. Simply lighten the load, do full reps, improve your strength, and only move up in weight when you can keep it fully under control. Injury risk mistake number two, using bad form. This is similar to the first mistake, but not the same. Form mistakes go far beyond the heavy half-repping that gives a bad name to the big compound lifts like the squat, deadlift, bench press, and military press. You can work with proper amounts of weight and use a full range of motion and still put yourself at a considerable risk of injury. For instance, even if you're working with weight you can handle properly, if you round your back during a deadlift or hyperextend it too far at the top, you're asking for a lower back injury. If you flatten your back and round your shoulders at the top of a bench press or flare your elbows out too much, you will probably have shoulder problems at some point. If you let your knees bow in when you squat or extend too far past your toes, you can hurt them when going heavy. If you do your overhead military presses behind your neck and your body is built like most people's, you're increasing your risk of injury. Strangely enough, some people's bodies just mechanically can handle this type of movement, but most don't do well with it. Pushing yourself in the gym is good, so long as you always maintain proper form as well. Injury risk mistake number three, failing to warm up properly. Many people's warm-up routines consist of a few minutes of static stretching, and this is a bad way of going about it. Static stretching before exercise has been shown to impair speed and strength. Not only can it fail to prevent injury, but it can also increase the risk of injury due to the cellular damage it causes to muscle and its analgesic effect. A proper warm-up routine should bring blood to the muscles that are about to be trained, increase suppleness, raise body temperature, and enhance free coordinated movement, which is why I prescribed the warm-up routine shared earlier in the book. The process of moving the muscles repeatedly through the expected ranges of motion has been shown to reduce the risk of injury. Injury risk mistake number four. No pain, no gain, bro. This might be obvious, but many people don't quite get it. If you experience pain, stop your set. If an exercise always bothers you, do something else. Realize that pain is a warning that something is wrong, and if you don't heed it, serious injury can follow. Case in point, probably the worst injury I've witnessed was a guy in his 60s at a bench press competition. He had just barely struggled out one rep with about 350 pounds, and then he started rubbing his elbow. He then told the guys to load more weight so he could go for a PR. Everyone was rooting him on. He got under the bar, unracked it, and got it halfway down. Then we heard a pop above the noise of the crowd. Fortunately, the spotters were on the ball and saved him from what looked like a near decapitation. His elbow had completely blown out, and I overheard an idiot telling him to just ice it and he'd be fine. In reality, he should have been on his way to the emergency room. The point is this. Don't be stupid. Aches and stiffness and such are common enough and usually go away once you warm up. But ignore and try to alpha your way through pain, and you're asking to get hurt. The key to dealing with pain is treating it like an injury until it's better. Avoid exercises that aggravate it and let it heal. If that means no deadlifting or squatting for a few weeks, so be it. Find alternative exercises that you can do. Annoying, yes, but an injury that sets you back several months is much more frustrating. How to recover from workout injuries. If you don't make the previously mentioned mistakes, your chances for injury are quite low, but stuff can happen, so let's talk about how to recover should you get hurt. First, if the injury is serious, you should see a doctor right away. Don't go home and put some ice on it and figure you'll be all right. That said, the most common injuries are minor muscle strains, which are fairly easy to recover from if you take the following actions. Rest. The most important part of recovery is rest, and it's simple. Don't put any stress on the affected body parts until they're fully healed. People who violate this simple principle can wind up with chronic dysfunction that can become quite a problem. Once the injured area feels healed, no more pain through a full range of motion, start to slowly train it again. Work with lighter weights and see how you feel the next day, and gradually work back into your normal routine. Ice. Ice helps you recover by reducing inflammation, swelling, and internal bleeding from injured capillaries and blood vessels. As long as there is pain and inflammation, ice will help. You should begin treatment with ice, not heat, and I recommend keeping a damp cloth between the ice pack and your skin to avoid discomfort. Don't apply ice for more than 15 to 20 minutes at a time, but you can rotate on and off all day. Compression. Like ice, compression helps you heal by reducing swelling and inflammation. Use an elastic bandage or a compression sleeve and wrap the injured part tightly, but not so tight as to impair blood flow. You can combine compression with ice by wrapping over the ice pack or by getting a product specifically designed to combine both ice and compression, like those offered by HyperIce. Elevation. By raising the affected part above your heart, you speed the blood's journey back to your heart, which reduces swelling and aids in removing waste products from the area. The bottom line. Don't think that injuries are inevitable in this game. By following the advice in this chapter, I've never had to deal with more than a strained muscle, knock on wood, and I wish the same for you. Chapter summary. Weightlifting isn't a dangerous activity. You're far more likely to get injured playing just about any sport than you are lifting weights. Those with injured joints may need to dial back the intensity of their weightlifting to preserve their joint health. If you can't get full reps, you're using too much weight, and you're increasing your risk of injury. Simply lighten the load, do full reps, improve your strength, and only move up in weight when you can keep it fully under control. Pushing yourself in the gym is good, so long as you always maintain proper form as well. Static stretching before exercise has been shown to impair speed and strength. Not only can it fail to prevent injury, but it may increase the risk of injury due to the cellular damage it causes to muscle and its analgesic effect. If you experience pain, stop your set. If an exercise always bothers you, do something else. The key to dealing with pain is treating it like an injury until it's better. Avoid exercises that aggravate it and let it heal. Section 5. Supplementation. Chapter 22. The No BS Guide to Supplements. What works, what doesn't, and what to watch out for. Biceps are like ornaments on a Christmas tree. Ed Cohen. The shelves of your local supplement store are packed with all kinds of bogus junk claiming to deliver results that only steroids can achieve. You know the claims. Advanced time-release formula guaranteed to feed your lean mass for up to 8 hours. Kick your testosterone production into overdrive and maximize your gains. Assault estrogen receptors in your body and completely block muscle-killing hormones. The products include pre, intra, and post-workout supplements, testosterone, human growth hormone, nitric oxide boosters, anti-estrogens, aromatase inhibitors, and the list goes on and on. If you believe half of the hype you read in supplement advertisements or on their labels, well, it would probably take a while before you realize the simple truth of the matter, which is, most everything you see in the world of workout supplements is utterly worthless. Yep, a complete waste of money. Not all, but most. How can I say that so confidently? Well, I've not only tried every type of supplement you can imagine, but I've also studied the science and am interested only in what has been objectively proven, not gym lore and fancy marketing pitches. You see, the supplement companies are cashing in big on a little trick that your mind can play on you, known as the placebo effect. This is the scientifically proven fact that your simple belief in the effectiveness of a medicine or supplement can make it work. People have alleviated and in many cases even cured a whole host of serious illnesses, both mental and physical, by taking medically inert, useless substances that they believed had therapeutic value. Thus, just because some guys believe that the shiny new bottle of muscle-maximizing pills will work and then feel them working doesn't mean they have any actual value. Unfortunately, however, the placebo effect doesn't seem to be strong enough to help us build more muscle with pixie dust, despite what we think might be happening. And the sad reality is many, most really, supplements hawked in gyms, magazines, and websites are nothing more than that, pixie dust. That is, the majority of ingredients in these products have never been scientifically proven to do anything like what is claimed, or better yet, they have been proven to be flat-out worthless. If you're wondering how companies can even get away with such an egregious scam, it's simple. The supplement industry is completely unregulated. You don't have to submit products to the FDA to start selling. You just whip something together, say whatever you want in your advertising, and voila, you're now in the supplement business. Watch the documentary Bigger, Stronger, Faster if you want to see how hilariously easy this is. The degenerates running certain supplement companies set the standard for unethical practices by doing things like spiking pre-workouts with methamphetamine-like substances. Yes, several large supplement companies were caught doing this, or adding a dangerous chemical extracted from dynamite to fat loss pills. One of the same companies did this as well. And well, they may get caught one day and fined, or not. I've had the displeasure of meeting several of these unsavory types, and I wasn't surprised to hear jokes about their latest pills in a bottle for customers to snap up, about how easy it is to just tell people what they want to hear and sell them anything, about how large the drug bills are of bodybuilders they sponsor. Yeah, some supplement companies pay for their athletes' steroids, but you're led to believe the magic pixie dust is the key to their physiques. About dishonest ways to fudge ingredient dosages and nutrition facts, such as amino-spiking protein powders, which entails filling them up with scoops of cheap amino acids that can be technically displayed as grams of protein, and more. That said, there are honest people and companies out there, and there are a handful of supplements worth buying and using. Most aren't the sexy muscle-building crap pushed by roid monsters in the magazines, but they are scientifically proven to help you in your journey to build muscle, get lean, and stay healthy. So, let's go through the common types of supplements and look at what you should and shouldn't spend your hard-earned cash on. And in the bonus report offered at the end of this book, you'll find my exact product recommendations, brands, and products themselves. Vitamin D. Just a few years ago, vitamin D was simply known as the bone vitamin, and even today, many physicians still believe it is essential only for bone health. Research shows otherwise, however. Insufficient vitamin D levels increase the risk of many types of disease, including osteoporosis, heart disease, stroke, some cancers, type 1 diabetes, multiple sclerosis, tuberculosis, and even the flu. But we're going to focus on the positive. Thanks to the hard work of many scientists, including the notable Dr. Michael Hollick, we now know that nearly every type of tissue and cell in the body has vitamin D receptors, which means it's an essential hormone that plays a vital role in a large number of physiological processes. When we ingest vitamin D, or produce it in the skin as a result of sun exposure, it gets converted into its active form, 1,25-dihydroxyvitamin D, or vitamin D3. This substance then interacts with and supports virtually every tissue type in your body, including your heart, brain, and even fat cells. It also regulates genes that control immune function, metabolism, and cell growth and development. As you can see, this vitamin deserves a lot more attention than it has been given over the last couple of decades. Fortunately, however, vitamin D's vital importance and amazing benefits are becoming more and more widely known and accepted. Now, as you may already know, our body can't produce vitamin D without sun exposure, and according to research published by the Center for Disease Control in 2011, 8% of Americans are vitamin D deficient, and 25% are considered at risk of a deficiency. According to other research, however, deficiency may be as high as 42%. There are two ways to ensure you get enough vitamin D. 1. Spend 15 to 20 minutes in the sun every day with at least 25% of your skin exposed. 2. Take supplements. As most of us aren't able to take midday tanning breaks, supplementation is the answer. How to take vitamin D. According to the Institute of Medicine, 600 IU per day is adequate for ages 1 to 70, and 800 IU per day for 70+. But these numbers have been severely criticized by scientists who specialize in vitamin D research. They call attention to the over 125 peer-reviewed studies that indicate such recommendations are too low and are likely to lead to vitamin D deficiencies. A committee of the U.S. Endocrine Society recently convened to review the evidence and concluded that between 600 and 1,000 IU per day is adequate for ages 1 to 18, and between 1,500 and 2,000 IU per day is adequate for ages 19+. According to Dr. Michael Hollick, however, even 2,000 IU per day is suboptimal. Research shows that 2,000 IU per day is the minimum needed to maintain vitamin D sufficiency, 30 milligrams per milliliter. But Dr. Hollick maintains that optimal vitamin D status is between 50 and 80 milligrams per milliliter, which would call for a daily intake closer to 5,000 IU. So, I recommend that you start at 2,000 IU per day and then get blood tested for your 25-hydroxyvitamin D levels, the usable form of vitamin D your body creates, to ascertain your vitamin D status. Chances are you'll come in below 50 to 80 milligrams per milliliter. Research shows that you need to increase intake of vitamin D by 100 IU to increase blood concentration by 1 milligram per milliliter, so you can then calculate how much additional vitamin D you'll need to take to reach optimal levels. For instance, if your test came back at 30 milligrams per milliliter and you wanted to raise it to 50 milligrams per milliliter, you would need to increase your current intake by 2,000 IU. Protein supplements. Using protein supplements such as whey, egg, and casein powders, your three best options, isn't necessary, but it is convenient. As you know, whey protein is a fantastic source of protein, and there are three forms you can buy it in: concentrate, isolate, and hydrolysate. Whey concentrate is the least processed form and the cheapest to manufacture, and it contains some fat and lactose. Whey concentrates range from 35 to 80% protein by weight, depending on quality. Whey isolate is a form of whey protein processed to remove the fat and lactose. Isolates are 90+% protein by weight, and as they're more expensive to manufacture than whey concentrate, they're more expensive for consumers too. Whey hydrolysate is a pre-digested form of whey protein that's easily absorbed by the body and free of allergenic substances found in milk products. Research indicates that the hydrolysis process improves solubility and digestibility, but you pay dearly for these benefits. Whey hydrolysate is the most expensive of the three options. So which should you buy? Well, when choosing a whey protein product, you have a few things to consider. While isolates and hydrolysates are pushed as superior to concentrates due to purity and higher protein concentrations per scoop, there's insufficient evidence to support claims that they are superior to concentrates in terms of meeting daily protein needs. That said, choosing the cheapest whey you can find, which will always be a concentrate, isn't a good idea either. A quality whey concentrate is somewhere around 80% protein by weight, but inferior concentrates can be as low as 30%. What else is in there then? Unfortunately, we can only wonder, as adulteration, the addition of fillers like maltodextrin and flour, is startlingly rampant in this industry. In many cases, you'll get what you pay for. If the product costs a lot less than the going rate for whey, it's probably because it's made with inferior ingredients. High prices aren't always indicative of high quality, though. Disreputable supplement companies also pull other tricks, such as starting with a low-quality concentrate, adding small amounts of isolate and hydrolysate to create a blend, and then calling attention to just the isolate and hydrolysate in their marketing and packaging. To protect yourself as a consumer, always check ingredient lists, serving sizes, and amounts of protein per serving before buying protein powder. Specifically, you're going to want to look at the order in which the ingredients are listed. Ingredients are listed in descending order according to predominance by weight, and the amount of protein per scoop relative to the scoop size. For instance, if a product has maltodextrin, a filler, or any other ingredient listed before the protein powder itself, don't buy it. That means there's more maltodextrin, creatine, or other fillers in it than protein powder. If a scoop is 40 grams but there are only 22 grams of protein per serving, don't buy it unless you know that the other 18 grams are made up of stuff you want. Weight gainers have quite a few carbs per scoop, for instance. A high-quality whey protein is easy to spot. Whey concentrate, isolate, or hydrolysate will be listed as the first ingredients, and the scoop size will be relatively close to the amount of protein per scoop. It'll never match because there is at least sweetener and flavoring along with the protein powder in every serving. Fortunately, there isn't as much to worry about with casein and egg supplements. Stick with a casein product that uses micellar casein, the highest quality available. And most egg products are comparable, but I prefer one company specifically, which you'll find in the bonus report. Weight gainers. Weight gainers are popular among hard gainers who struggle with gaining weight. But I'm not a fan of them because they're almost always full of junk calories. I much prefer to see guys eating real food with nutrition. My general recommendation to people struggling to eat enough is to stick mainly to calorie-dense foods, like the following. Red meat. Grains like brown rice and quinoa, oils like coconut oil and olive oil, avocado, whole-fat dairy, multigrain pasta and bread, almonds and almond butter, bananas, and white and sweet potatoes. If you focus on these types of foods in your meal planning, you should have no trouble reaching your daily caloric needs without having to resort to weight gainers. Branched-chain amino acids, BCAAs. You know that gallon of pink liquid the hardcore bodybuilder in your gym lugs around from machine to machine? Chances are that it's a cocktail of branched-chain amino acids, BCAAs, and that he'll swear by its muscle-building powers. If you listen to the hype, BCAA supplements sound damn near as effective as steroids in their ability to help you build muscle and strength. But, as is the case with many supplements, you're not being told the whole story. Simply put, while BCAAs do have a valid use, which we'll talk about, they're not nearly as effective as they're sold to be. We'll break down why, but let's start at the beginning. What exactly are BCAAs anyway? BCAAs are a group of three essential amino acids that your body must get from your diet. Leucine, isoleucine, and valine. Leucine is the star of the trio, as it directly stimulates protein synthesis via the action of an enzyme responsible for cell growth known as the mammalian target of rapamycin, or mTOR. Isoleucine is the number two act on the list, as it improves glucose metabolism and increases muscular uptake. Valine is a distant third, as it doesn't seem to do much of anything when compared to leucine and isoleucine. You find high amounts of these amino acids in quality proteins, such as meat, eggs, and dairy products, with whey protein isolate being particularly high. If I wanted to sell you a BCAA supplement, it wouldn't be too hard. I could cite a variety of scientifically validated benefits, such as improved immune function, reduced fatigue, reduced levels of exercise-induced muscle damage, increased levels of post-exercise muscle growth, and more. Basically, I could just tell the same story that just about every supplement company selling BCAAs tells, and it would be hard to refute at first glance. But there are two important points you're not told about BCAA research. Research commonly cited that demonstrates muscle-related benefits of BCAA supplementation was done with subjects who didn't eat enough protein. For example, a study conducted by researchers at the Center for Studies and Research of Aerospace Medicine, France, is one of the poster boys for selling BCAAs. Scientists examined the effects of BCAA supplementation on a group of elite wrestlers in a calorie deficit, and after 3 weeks, the supplement group, who ingested an additional 52 grams of BCAAs per day, preserved more muscle and lost a bit more fat than the control group, who didn't supplement at all. Sounds pretty cool, right? Well, what you won't hear is that subjects, whose average weight was about 150 pounds, were eating a paltry 80 grams of protein per day. As you know, based on research on the protein needs of athletes and a calorie restriction, they should have been eating double that amount of protein to preserve lean mass. So all that study tells us is that if we feel like eating half the amount of protein we should be eating, a BCAA supplement can help mitigate the damage. Not too exciting. Other studies that demonstrate various muscle-related benefits of BCAA supplementation have promising abstracts, but they are almost always hampered by a lack of dietary control and or a low protein intake. Furthermore, in almost all cases, the subjects are training fasted, which is an important point we'll talk more about in a minute. You can get all the BCAAs your body needs from food instead, which is cheaper and far more satisfying. Research that demonstrates the anabolic effects of BCAA supplementation before, during, and after exercise is often used to sell the powders. But this misses the forest for the trees. What such research tells us is that acutely raising BCAA levels, and leucine in particular, before and after exercise helps us build more muscle. There is no evidence that doing it through the ingestion of a BCAA supplement is more effective than food, however. In fact, there's research to the contrary. Food, and whey protein specifically, may be even more effective than amino acid drinks. Most whole food proteins are made up of about 15% BCAAs, and most protein supplements have BCAAs added. So when you're eating enough protein, especially if you're using protein supplements with BCAAs added, you're getting more than enough BCAAs to meet your body's demands. This is why I recommend that you eat 30 to 40 grams of protein before and after working out, and why I use whey protein for these meals. It's cheaper than BCAA powders, tastes better, and is likely more effective. So that's how things currently look when we strip away the hype and marketing angles. But before I move on to one legitimate use for BCAAs, I want to address a question that may have occurred to you. Isn't there a study that had resistance-trained subjects lift weights and supplement with BCAAs while also on a high-protein diet? I wish, because that would lend great insight into the controversy. All we currently have is an unpublished study paid for by Sivation, the creator of the popular Xtend BCAA supplement, and headed up by Jim Stoppani, that demonstrated some remarkable results. Daily intra-workout BCAA supplementation was twice as effective as intra-workout whey protein supplementation, and resulted in a whopping 9 pounds of muscle growth and a 2% reduction in body fat in just 8 weeks. In strength-trained men with at least 2 years of weightlifting experience, who were eating 2.2 to 2.4 grams of protein per kilogram of body weight, and were in a calorie surplus. Wait, what? If I take BCAAs, no, sorry, not just any BCAAs, but Extend, while I work out, I can be in a calorie surplus and achieve steroid-level muscle growth and get leaner? Wow. Shut up and take all my money, Syvation. Not. Color me skeptical here. To quote the popular fitness researcher and author Alan Aragon in his monthly research review, the skeptic in me is tempted to chalk up some of the results to not just funding source, Syvation, but also the long-standing friendship, footnote added, between Jim Stapani and the Syvation staff. The fact is, there's no way to quantify the degree of commercial bias inherent in this trial, or any other for that matter. Okay then, so BCAAs don't look to be nearly as exciting as the supplement companies say. If you were on the fence about buying a BCAA supplement for general use, you're probably off it now. It turns out, however, that this supplement does have one scientifically supported use, and it relates to fasted training. People usually think fasted training means training on an empty stomach, but it's a bit different. Fasted training means training in a fasted state, and this has to do with insulin levels in your blood. As you know, when you eat food, it gets broken down into various molecules that your cells can use, and these molecules are released into your blood. Insulin is released as well, and its job is to shuttle these molecules into cells. Your body enters a fasted state when it has finished absorbing all nutrients from the food you've eaten, and insulin levels return to their normal, low baseline levels. When you exercise your body in this state, fat loss is accelerated, and weightlifting in a fasted state is particularly effective in this regard. There is a downside to fasted training, however, and this is where we get to BCAAs. When you exercise in a fasted state, muscle breakdown is dramatically increased. This is bad simply because too much muscle breakdown impairs total muscle growth over time. Preventing this is simple, though, and it involves taking BCAAs. How to take BCAAs. All you have to do is take 10 grams of BCAAs or 3 to 5 grams of leucine. Warning, it tastes bad. 10 to 15 minutes before fasted training. This suppresses muscle breakdown during your workout with a minimal impact on insulin levels, thus keeping you in a fasted state. Pre-workout supplements. Advertisements for popular pre-workout products are some of the most exaggerated in the industry. If we're to believe what we're told, just a few scoops of powder will basically turn us into superheroes for an hour. I mean, the monstrous bodybuilders who look like they're about to die of a heart attack wouldn't lie, right? Well, pre-workout supplements are notorious for a few deceitful practices, including small amounts of cheap, ineffective ingredients to make long, impressive ingredient lists, and using, and often misinterpreting, cherry-picked, flawed, or biased studies to convince you why the formulation is awesome. Underdosing effective ingredients to save money and hiding behind the proprietary blend labeling loophole that allows companies to not disclose the dosage of each part of the blend. Using chemical names of everyday compounds to mislead you into thinking the products have special ingredients. For instance, Epigallo 3 Catechin 3-OB Gallate is just green tea extract. And 1,3-7-trimethylxanthine is just caffeine. Why do these things? Because it's extremely profitable. You see, here's the game. When Shady Supplements Incorporated is looking to create a pre-workout supplement, it believes that two things are key for sales. One, including a few ingredients that have been clinically proven as safe and effective so marketing claims can be defended. And two, including a bunch of other unproven junk to give you the impression that you're getting a lot for your money. There's a problem, though, and it relates to cost. You see, using clinically effective dosages of worthwhile ingredients gets really expensive, really fast. Shady Supplements' business model revolves around spending as little on production as possible and pouring tons of cash into its marketing and its greedy owners' pockets, so it just can't afford to make a good product. What to do instead? Simple. Include small amounts of these key ingredients, much smaller than the dosages used in the actual research proving them to be effective. Then pad the ingredients list with tiny amounts of a bunch of junk for good measure. These companies don't want you to know how much of each ingredient is in the product, however, as you might get suspicious. Again, the solution is simple. Use the proprietary blend, which allows them to list just the weight of everything in the blend, not of the individual ingredients themselves. Because ingredients in proprietary blends are listed in descending order according to predominance by weight, when the first ingredient is something cheap, let's say maltodextrin, a sweet or sometimes tasteless filler, or creatine monohydrate, it could be and often is 90%+ of the actual product. No matter how many other ingredients are listed after the first, they could all together only constitute a small percentage of the actual blend. Next, Shady Supplements' marketing department gets a hold of the product and lists all the benefits it can find for higher dosages of the underdosed ingredients, often stretching these to the point of absurdity, and then it adds a few more claims based on nothing to round it out. In the end, this means you pay $30 to $50 for a product that costs Shady Supplements $2 to $5 to manufacture, and that would have cost $30 to create if the junk were dropped and proper dosages were used for the worthwhile ingredients. If you want to help put an end to all of this chicanery, the first thing you should demand as a consumer is no proprietary blends. There's absolutely no reason to use them for anything other than deception and fraud. All the science behind effective ingredients is publicly available. Everyone knows what works and doesn't, and in what dosages. Claims of trade secrets or proprietary research are bogus. You should also know that the inclusion of more ingredients doesn't necessarily mean a better product. In fact, you won't find a legitimate pre-workout product with 30 ingredients, because it's not financially feasible to include so many ingredients at clinically effective dosages. And you would be hard-pressed to even find 30 ingredients worth using, period. By choosing your purchases wisely, you can force the changes that need to happen, the death of the proprietary blend, and the use of only scientifically validated ingredients at clinically effective dosages with the elimination of ineffective label filler ingredients. So then, this brings us to the million-dollar question. Are any pre-workout supplements worth using? Or should we just stick to our trusty friend, caffeine? Well, caffeine is a useful pre-workout stimulant that can increase muscle endurance and strength. But the fact is, there are several other safe, natural substances that can further improve your performance, if they're dosed properly. So, all things considered, a good pre-workout supplement is worth the investment, in my opinion. It will give you a kick of energy, more focus, a good pump, and increased muscle endurance. One thing you should know about pre-workout drinks, however, is that most contain quite a bit of caffeine per serving, anywhere from 100 to 300 milligrams. If your body is sensitive to caffeine, you might want to try one with little or no caffeine. Creatine. Creatine is a substance found naturally in the body and in foods like red meat. It is perhaps the most researched dietary supplement in the world of sports nutrition. It has been the subject of more than 200 studies. Research shows that supplementation with creatine builds muscle and improves strength, increases anaerobic endurance, and reduces muscle damage and soreness from exercise. And in case you're worried that creatine is bad for your kidneys, these claims have been categorically and repeatedly disproven. In healthy subjects, creatine has been shown to have no harmful side effects in both short and long-term usage. People with kidney disease are not advised to supplement with creatine, however. Thus, creatine is one of the supplements I highly recommend that you take. There are different forms available, though. Which is the best? Well, the monohydrate form has been the subject of the vast majority of studies done on the creatine molecule and is a proven winner. But the marketing machines of supplement companies are constantly pumping up fancy-sounding stuff like creatine citrate, creatine ethyl ester, liquid creatine, creatine nitrate, buffered creatine, creatine hydrochloride, and others. These variations are certainly more expensive than creatine monohydrate, but they're no more effective. Certain forms of creatine are more water-soluble, such as creatine citrate, nitrate, and hydrochloride, but this doesn't make them more effective in your body. Don't overpay for overhyped forms of creatine, pushed by million-dollar ad campaigns and sold in fancy bottles. Creatine monohydrate is the best bang for your buck and is the standard by which all other forms of creatine are still judged. If plain old creatine monohydrate bothers your stomach, try a more water-soluble form of creatine, such as micronized creatine monohydrate or creatine citrate, nitrate, or hydrochloride. How to take creatine. The most common method of creatine supplementation found in the literature is a loading period of 20 grams per day for 5 to 7 days, followed by a maintenance dosage of 5 grams per day. You don't have to load creatine if you're just starting with supplementation. You can just start with 5 grams per day, but loading does cause the creatine to accumulate faster in the muscles and thus causes the benefits to kick in faster. Research shows that co-ingesting creatine with carbohydrates increases creatine accumulation in the muscles. As this effect is mainly a result of elevated insulin levels, protein intake can contribute as well. In fact, one study conducted by researchers at the University of Nottingham demonstrated that 50 grams of protein and carbohydrates were equally effective as 100 grams of carbohydrates in augmenting muscular creatine accumulation. So, based on this research, you should take creatine with a good-sized meal to maximize its effects. Furthermore, there's research that indicates that creatine taken after a workout is more effective than creatine taken before one, which is why I take my creatine with my post-workout meal, consisting of about 50 grams of protein and 75 to 125 grams of carbs. Do you have to cycle creatine? No, there's no scientific evidence that long-term creatine usage is harmful, so no, there's no reason to cycle on and off it. It's not a steroid. Does caffeine interfere with creatine's effects? Maybe. One study conducted by researchers at the University of Leuven demonstrated that ingesting caffeine with creatine monohydrate decreases muscular force production when compared to ingesting just creatine monohydrate alone. But this isn't enough evidence to close the case. That's especially true considering the fact that a study conducted by researchers at University of Luton demonstrated that caffeine and creatine monohydrate taken together were more effective than just creatine monohydrate in improving the performance of high-intensity interval cardio. Similar results were seen in a study conducted by researchers at Yuda University, Taiwan, as well. Based on the evidence, I like to play it safe and take my creatine and caffeine separately, not together like what you find in most pre-workout drinks. Does creatine make you bloated? This used to be a problem, but in the last decade or so, processing has improved greatly, and it's a non-issue now. It's unlikely that you'll notice any difference in subcutaneous water retention when you take creatine, even if you're quite lean. Should you take creatine while dieting for fat loss? Yes, creatine works equally well when you're in a calorie deficit, which means you'll retain more strength and thus lean mass while cutting. Testosterone boosters. While studies have shown that you can increase testosterone levels by handling deficiencies in certain vitamins, such as D and C, and minerals such as zinc, calcium, and magnesium, the flashy test boosters sold in your local supplement store are generally just a waste of money. Some go to town with their ingredients, but most rely on one or more of the following: tribulus terrestris, ZMA, or D-aspartic acid. Multiple studies have proven that supplementation with tribulus terrestris has no effect on testosterone levels, body composition, or exercise performance. Research has shown that supplementation with ZMA does not affect testosterone levels if you're not zinc deficient. And while research has shown that supplementation with D-aspartic acid can increase testosterone levels in both humans and rats, the effect is usually slight and temporary. If you want to try it, however, just buy the amino itself and take 3 grams per day. The bottom line is that supplements that aim to handle vitamin and mineral deficiencies that suppress testosterone levels can be worthwhile, but these are rarely marketed as test boosters and fall under the less sexy category of male health instead. Human growth hormone boosters. Simply put, natural human growth hormone boosters are a complete waste of money. They're usually full of amino acids that do provide various benefits when dosed properly, but not an increase in levels of growth hormone associated with muscle growth. You see, there are more than 100 forms of growth hormone in your body, and all perform different functions. When you're told that something like gamma-aminobutyric acid, or GABA, has been proven to elevate resting and post-exercise growth hormone levels, what you're not told is that the form of growth hormone that it stimulates the production of hasn't been proven to contribute to muscle growth. Save your money and skip the human growth hormone boosters. Glutamine. Glutamine is the most abundant amino acid in the body and is heavily depleted by intense, prolonged exercise. Research has shown that supplementation with glutamine can reduce the negative effects of prolonged exercise on the immune system. Research has shown that exercise depletes glutamine levels in the body, which in turn can impair immune function. Improve your endurance and reduce fatigue in prolonged exercise, and help your body better deal with the systemic stress of prolonged exercise. While supplementation with glutamine clearly has its benefits, it can't deliver on the claims commonly used to sell it, which revolve around building more muscle. These claims usually cite research that has shown that intramuscular glutamine levels play an important role in protein synthesis and the prevention of muscle breakdown, and that glutamine improves the body's ability to use leucine. The rest of the story, however, is that there are no studies to indicate that supplementation with glutamine helps healthy, well-fed adults build more muscle. You only see these effects in diseased or underfed people and animals. To the contrary, in fact, several studies conducted with healthy adults show that supplementation with glutamine has no effect on protein synthesis rates, muscle performance, body composition, or the prevention of muscle breakdown. So, while supplementation with glutamine may not provide an anabolic boost, its anti-stress and anti-fatigue benefits make it a worthwhile buy if you're exercising regularly, intensely, and for prolonged periods. How to take glutamine. Studies have shown that 100 to 200 milligrams per kilogram of body weight of glutamine each day is sufficient for athletes and that chronic usage is important. Nitric oxide supplements. These supplements often consist of a form of the amino acids arginine and citrulline and the substance agmatine. They claim to increase the body's production of a substance called nitric oxide. Nitric oxide widens blood vessels and thus enables more oxygen and nutrients to get to the muscles, which can improve performance. While this sounds like just another dubious marketing pitch, there are studies to support some of these ingredients and claims. But again, the problem comes back to dosages. You'll often find nitric oxide boosting molecules in pre-workout products, but in amounts too small to matter. That said, when dosed properly, about 8 grams, I've noticed that citrulline in particular improves workout pump and performance. Multivitamins. As with most supplements, multivitamins are aggressively overhyped and oversold. Advertisements loudly proclaim that just a few pills per day will ward off disease, optimize hormones, support the gut, enhance cognitive function, and increase energy levels. Some are even bolder, claiming their multivitamins will also help you build muscle, get stronger, and lose fat. On the other side of the coin, however, are the people claiming that multivitamins are a complete waste of money and offer absolutely no health benefits whatsoever, or are even dangerous to our health. Well, the truth lies somewhere in the middle. Why a multivitamin is great, in theory. Your body needs a wide spectrum of vitamins and minerals to carry out the millions of sophisticated functions it performs every day. You want to maintain an adequate supply of vitamins and minerals to support every growth and repair process that occurs. Ideally, we'd get all of the vitamins and minerals we need from the food we eat. Due to the nature of the average Western diet, however, we tend to be deficient in certain vitamins and minerals. For example, according to research conducted by scientists at Colorado State University published in 2005, at least half the U.S. population fails to meet the recommended dietary allowance, RDA, for vitamin B6, vitamin A, magnesium, calcium, and zinc, and 33% of the population does not meet the RDA for folate. Research also shows that average vitamin K and D intake levels may be suboptimal as well. What to do then? How can we easily ensure our bodies get enough of all of the essential vitamins and minerals? Enter the multivitamin supplement. The idea of taking a supplement that can cover any possible nutritional deficiencies in our diets and mitigate the harmful effects of some of our less than healthy habits is a great concept. It would create a safety buffer for our health. That's the least you should expect from a multivitamin in reality. The right combination of vitamins and minerals and the right dosages. This would at least plug any dietary holes and ensure your body is getting adequate micronutrients. I think it should do more, though. Namely, there are scores of natural substances that have been scientifically proven to ward off disease